Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. And greetings, wonderful Earth Explorers. We're so glad you're here with us tonight. We're coming to you live from east of the Appalachian Mountains. Our AccuWindow forecast, 86 degrees and sunny, a little bit windy out of the west. The solar wind is the highest we have seen in a few years at 642 kilometers per second. And high latitude sky watchers, if it's dark where you live, go out and look for auroras. A geomagnetic storm is underway after a high-speed solar wind gust hit Earth's magnetic field today. An unstable nest of magnetic fields emerged over the sun's northeastern horizon today, and it is crackling with C-class solar flares. Although the maelstrom does have a small dark core, technically making it a sunspot, it has not yet been sunspot numbered by the NOAA. Listeners with solar telescopes are encouraged to keep an eye on the no-name active region. It's where the action is. Also, have you been to the new SDO website, the Solar Dynamics Observatory? The new cameras are working, and the images are absolutely breathtaking. The 3D imaging of the sun right down on the surface is absolutely stunning. I highly recommend you bookmark the page and go there often. We will have the link at X Squared Radio's website. So if you can't remember the Solar Dynamics Observatory in Google, just go to X Squared Radio and you can get to it from there. Also, the verdict is in. We've been telling you this for a couple of years now. China is still the top holder of U.S. government debt. The Treasury said in a report on Friday. Friday's report shows that China's holdings have declined since the end of last year by $17.3 billion as of February, just a couple of months ago, but nevertheless still remained the top foreign holder with $877.5 billion. Japan, in February of this year, had $768.5 billion, while the UK had $233.5 billion. I hope you see that this means that China sold off over $17 billion of its U.S. bonds in a time when our economy was suffering the worst. You haven't seen anything yet. There were 44 earthquakes in the past 24 hours. Three of them were over 5.0. But the earthquakes are spread out everywhere, from Utah to Fiji to Russia. The whole earth is ringing right now. Could something be about to happen? Also, don't forget, my new book, Remembering the Future, is available in ebook format right now. The printed version will take 58 more days and counting, but you can read it now, and you get a 25% discount off the printed version by going to rememberingthefuturebook.com. rememberingthefuturebook.com. And don't forget, Twitter is alive and well on X Squared Radio. All kinds of people following what's going on, including NASA. I add stuff all day as we approach the announcement on the expedition above the Arctic Circle. And also when we're getting ready to launch the first affordable electric vehicle. So stay tuned. And if you're not part of Twitter, just go to X Squared Radio. The last few tweets are right there on the cover page. Shouldn't be any problem to get in there. Also, don't forget to click on the Web Talk Radio link at X Squared Radio. It's a short 30-minute version of the program, And the more you click and the more your friends click, the better our chances are of syndication. That means we get to play on the airwaves. So let's spread the word. We need something positive out there. Dr. Amit Goswami was born in India. He moved to the United States early in his career, where he was a physics teacher for some 32 years at the University of Oregon Institute for Theoretical Physics. He is convinced, along with a number of others who subscribe to the same view, that the universe, in order to exist, requires a conscious, sentient being to be aware of it. Without an observer, he claims, it only exists as a possibility. And he is our guest tonight. Welcome to the program, Dr. Goswami. How are you?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
This is an amazing privilege for me and also for the listeners. I have long been a fan of your work, and I very much appreciate your approach and your awakening. I want to start here. You know, when people think about physics, some people have nightmares about the math they faced in high school or college. But there really are two ends of physics, two camps, as it were. On the one hand, we have the world of possibilities in the very small, where there is no gravity, and we have the world of possibilities in the very large, where gravity is evident. It is more acceptable and perhaps more experimentally evident to assert that consciousness has, at the very least, an effect on changing matter for energy. At first consideration, it seems maybe less agreeable that the same presence has an effect on planets and suns. But what do you think?
Well, actually, you know, this matter, energy, planet, sun, gravity, all forces, this is all matter. Einstein's theory of relativity tells us that matter, energy are all just matter. What name you call it hardly is relevant. So what quantum physics is saying is something drastically different. Quantum physics saying that everything, planets, stars, whatever have you, whatever matter in whatever form, including energy, they're all possibilities for consciousness to choose from. So without consciousness choosing, all the universe, material universe, remain just that possibility. When we choose our experience. Along with ourselves, we create the universe.
Ah, so consciousness has an effect on everything. Now, you have said that the current worldview has it, that everything is made of matter, and everything can be reduced to the elementary particles of matter, the basic constituents, you know, quarks, as it were, building blocks of matter. But are these really the building blocks of matter, and is this matter all that makes up the universe?
Exactly. That is the point, and quantum physics is saying that they are only part of the universe. Indeed, universe requires these possibilities, material possibilities. But there is much more to the universe than that. First of all, the possibilities remain possibilities without consciousness. So consciousness is needed as the ground of being. The possibilities must belong to a conscious, basic conscious being. Consciousness is the ground of being in which matter exists as possibilities. And then, since you are positing matter as possibilities of consciousness, immediately our mind becomes free to include mind also as possibilities and our vital energies that we feel, and even archetypes that we intuit. So the position that I take is that consciousness has four compartments of possibility. We really live in four different worlds. One world is the material world, which we sense, but then there is another world of vital energies that we feel. Then there is the mental world of meaning that we think, and then the archetypal world of archetypes such as love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness that we intuit. So we are made of four different bodies in all these four different worlds. We are much too limited in the material worldview. And this limitation is making us more and more limited. You know, all this stuff that we suffer from today, I really believe that they're fundamentally coming because everybody has become more limited than they are and narrow. And their narrowness is striking. No, I mean, just compare 50 years ago. I mean, Americans, they're suffering from a very myopic narrowness. It's not helping anyone.
Well, I can tell you just by looking around that the narrowness is only in their mind. It's not in their backsides.
Exactly.
you talk about consciousness probabilities. You know, I meet all kinds of people. Some of them realize that they're conscious, and others don't realize that they're conscious. They think that everything is handed to them with no choice, and life is some kind of irrevocable destiny. But there is some causation to consciousness and matter and the universe, is there not?
Yes. Matter has causation. That's the material causation, and that causation gives us possibilities. And consciousness has causation. That's the causation that gives us choice from possibilities and gives us conscious experience. So in this view, the material causation, which you call upward causation, because cause rises upward from elementary particles to atoms, to molecules, to cells, to us, to the brain. But there is also downward causation, which is conscious choice from the possibilities offered to consciousness. And we pick the particular facet of possibility that we want to be our experience in that particular observation. And that's how the manifest world comes to be. There is the unmanifest consisting of possibility, and then there is the manifest. This explains the tremendous insight that Freud and Jung had in the last century about our unconscious, the world being unconscious and conscious. Materialists have no explanation why the world is split between unconscious and conscious. Finally, with quantum physics, we are understanding this basic psychological wisdom.
Well, you talked about downward causation, that of free will being exerted upon entropy, but what is upward causation?
Upward causation is the causation of matter, material interactions that produce all these waves of possibility for consciousness to choose from. So we need upward causation because that gives us variety of properties and attributes and aspects that matter presents to us constantly. Matter is as essential part of this description as is consciousness. Without matter, the manifest world could not exist.
Sure.
But without consciousness to choose, the world would again be unmanifest. So we need both matter and consciousness.
Well, that's stunning in and of itself. But when we think about, I was going to say, at least from a physics point of view, we have traditionally thought that free will did not exist. But that's the current paradigm, right?
That's the material view. Free will doesn't exist.
But
free will very much exists, and what it consists of. It consists of choosing from quantum possibilities.
Well, do you think that there's some sort of teleology to the design of the universe and the function of energy?
Thank you for mentioning teleology. Absolutely. If it is consciousness that is the ground of being, why is the manifest world at all? Manifest world is built for the purpose of making the unconscious conscious. I mentioned unmanifest and then the manifest. So manifestation proceeds in time from the unmanifest. Unmanifest are all the possibilities, all the meaning, all the archetypal goodness, love, and all that. And that has to gradually manifest in the manifest world. So we have evolution. Evolution is part and parcel of the manifest world. Manifest world would have no meaning if there were no evolution. But this evolution is not Darwinian. It's a purposive evolution of consciousness itself. The proof of that is that there are gaps in the biological evolution, the fossil gaps, which you cannot explain unless you include creativity. And creativity is a property of consciousness. Well, matter does not have creativity. Matter cannot have creativity.
So you think these leaps in consciousness might be directly responsible for leaps in biology as well?
Absolutely. Leaps in biological evolution. And those leaps are the ones that has produced us. You know, we began with a single cell 4.5 or something, some billion years ago. And then this life has evolved, becoming multiple cells, becoming all the invertebrates and eventually vertebrates, and then mammals, and then primates, and then finally us. what a brilliant progression, that this progression required the quantum leaps of consciousness.
So the leaps in what we call irreducible complexity is yes. really a demand, a choice of the consciousness inside that being.
Yes. Yes, I'm glad you used the word irreducible complexity. I love it. This is Michael Behe, a great biologist. He's coined the term first. But, you know, this is also the essence of holism, the whole that cannot be reduced to its parts. And it is also the essential component of the quantum theory, where we bring in the concept of tangled hierarchy. You cannot make a tangled hierarchy by simply building it step by step. So the same idea of irreducible complexity is now approached from three different views, and all the views have solidly this concept, and it is required to explain the intricacies, various intricacies of evolution. There is just no doubt about it. And the existence of this irreducible complexity or holistic ingredients or tangled hierarchy proves that consciousness is involved, purposiveness is involved, creativity is involved in biological evolution. Darwinian theory is only part of it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, just natural selection can be observed all over the planet and inside species, but you don't really see, you know, wholesale changes in for instance, winged lizards or something like that, because they want to get from one island to another. But I have seen, and at least there is some anthropological evidence, that modern man is evolving. We are seeing a difference about every 100 years in the mental and physical capabilities of human beings.
Especially mental. The evolution of human beings mostly is in the way that we process meaning, mental meaning. So, for example, when we are hunters and gatherers, the anthropological data really says that we are giving meaning mainly to the physical world. Then with the invention of instruments such as hoe, agriculture started small scale first, and that's when we started giving meaning to vital energies. This is called the vital mind. And then we developed the rational mind, which is what is going on right now with the development of the plow, basically. And we have been rational mind for a long time, and it's time to change. And I think that this change is being reflected partially in this paradigm shift that we are talking about, from primacy of matter to primacy of consciousness. And there are many other facets. For example, I really think that the current crisis is not the end of all crises. These crisis conditions are only going to amplify further. For example, the economic crisis, you know, in my view, we haven't seen nothing yet. I mean, this is, we are doing economics, we have distorted Adam Smith's economics so far that it's breaking down. And unless we could take drastic measure, which I don't think we can, unless we change the worldview. So when is the worldview going to change? Is it going to change tomorrow? We are incapable of it. So worldview is going to change in its own time, taking maybe a couple of decades. So economic situation will get worse and worse. And all the other problems that we see, like terrorism and environmental disasters, these are also going to become more and more acute. And then when the paradigm changes, then all of a sudden things are going to get better. And in that betterness will come the new way that mind gives meaning. I think we'll be a much more loving, much more ethical beings in just about a few decades. I really think that these crises are not for nothing. It's signifying a huge change that is coming to us.
I'm smiling here because I'm kind of recalling stories of my own grandfather. It had something to do with hell and handbaskets. and we also are not spending the gross amount of our anthropological efforts on feeding one another, but more on killing one another. So I think when that changes, we'll, will definitely make a leap. You made a reference to entanglement. I want to talk a little bit about entangled particle theory, because we'll lay a foundation here, and then we'll make a big jump in the next hour and bring all this around science and spirituality all woven into one. Tell us a little bit about entangled particle theory. We hear it from non-physicists all the time, and I think sometimes we get off track. But can you tell us what that involves?
Well, there are several concepts here. The one that you are referring is called entanglement or correlation.
Right.
This is an aspect of a phenomenon called quantum non-locality. Ordinary interactions, material interactions, they proceed locally with signals. So we call them interaction with the exchange of energy or signals. But in quantum physics, there is an interconnectivity that allows one to communicate without any signal. We call it a non-local quantum connection or correlation or entanglement between objects who can communicate non-locally. So it's the ability of objects to communicate non-locally that is the idea of quantum entanglement or quantum correlation. This is absolutely a very essential component of the new physics. It is also a very essential component of our spirituality, essential component of our creativity. In other words, all the things that matter isn't. Matter is incapable of non-local communication, material interactions don't permit non-local communication. But with quantum physics, because everything is embedded in a non-local consciousness, this non-local communication is permitted, not as a property of matter, but as a property of consciousness.
Hmm.
Non-locality is the inherent aspect of consciousness. And so what you were asking in terms of quantum entanglement, that is one of the fundamental new phenomenon that is opening us to new possibilities, new potential that we have not known before.
I think it's amazing that new fundamentals are entering a science that's already so old and has had such brilliant minds behind it for well over 100 years, but we are now seeing new fundamentals. when we talk about entanglement, we talk about these two particles reacting non-locally. Are there any thoughts about whether there are two particles somehow linked to one another, like an irrevocable Pauli exclusion, or are they actually the same particle existing in two locations at once?
How are the two particles? Their interaction just triggers this non-local connection between them. The non-local connection is inherent. It's a connection to consciousness. This is the way that they interact. They interact because they are one. They ultimately are connected, but not through space-time, but through the oneness that they share with consciousness. They are both possibilities of consciousness, and therefore consciousness connects them. So if you think that way, then all paradoxes disappear.
Well, I could see how you and I could think that way. But, when my brother first told me about this, he was a dean of physiology at Johns Hopkins for, 20 years. When he first told me about, for instance, the aspect experiment, I had a hard time believing it, at least from a scientific point of view. But when you throw in, shall we call it, the consciousness constant, then it really gets spooky.
Yeah, it's spooky, all right. You know, this is what Einstein called a spooky action at a distance. He never could believe it. But, of course, it died long before a space experiment was performed. If a space experiment was performed during Einstein's life, then I wonder how Einstein would have felt. He would have such a radical change of worldview all of a sudden. You know, that would be fun to watch.
Well, that's true, and he had so many benchmarks, and he was a consolidative physicist. There were many experts, but they couldn't speak in a consolidated way where the public could actually understand it. But Einstein was a master at doing that, and he had several benchmarks that, you know, as experiments with astrophysics got better and better, it proved out his theories almost exactly.
Yeah, Yeah, much of it, absolutely. And one of the things that Einstein always had, that experimental data, as soon as experimental data came out, he wouldn't fight it. He would immediately accept it and he would try to understand it.
Sure.
This is one thing that currently all the physicists, they cannot do. They are so inflexible. Experimental data is now clearly showing that we need downward causation. We need consciousness to understand quantum physics, understand the world as we know it, as we experience it.
Yeah.
But these physicists are completely blind to it. They deny experimental data. You know, today we have data where one person meditates and another person with another person with the intention that they will have non-local communication. And then this person sees a light flash or a series of light flashes. And somehow this brain activity of this person is transferred to the other brain, as shown by electroencephalogram machines which are connected to both brains. And both brains show the same kind of brainwave signals. How can that be? How can electrical signals from one brain get to another without an electromagnetic connection? So, you know, even in view of this kind of experiment, which has now been repeated 4 or 5 times, replicated in different laboratories, even then, these scientists are completely blind to them. They decide not to engage with it and retain their faith in materialism, scientific materialism, that matter is everything. And so much publicity, you know, this news media is another problem. Of course, your radio show is an exception, you know. Most of media, similarly, ignores the paradigm shift that is going on. That explains so much more, and we already have technologies even. But still, this is a frustrating state of affairs.
Yeah, it is. One of the things that it's really in the news, and I think it's been at the top of the paranormal news for a long time, and that is in the local view of the universe, the speed of light is the limit. And when we think about the speed of light as the speed limit of the universe, the advent of different races communicating across space becomes very improbable.
Yes. In fact, the question is really becomes moot, in my judgment. It we should not even raise such issues with their extraterrestrial intelligence, because how are we going to communicate with them staying within the speed of light limit? But
yeah,
non-locality puts a monkey wrench in all of this kind of consideration. It makes us into citizen of the galaxy, citizen of the universe, instead of just being citizen of the Earth. This issue alone should change the paradigm.
Sure. Yeah, the idea that evidence shows up experimentally or empirically that doesn't fit the paradigm of the current religion of science, so they just throw it out. Stating unequivocally, at least my astronomy friends say, UFOs don't exist because it's impossible to travel across the expanse of space, even at the speed of light. Well, their premise is flawed, so their conclusion is flawed.
Yes.
Well, I have a question. The distance of space, what does it look like from the perspective of a photon, say, emitted on the star Arcturus, for instance, as it looks toward Earth? What does space look like to the photon?
Well, this is a good question. For the photon, because it moves exactly at the speed of light, space contracts away completely. You know, there is a phenomenon called Lorentz contraction. This is within the theory of relativity. So if you are sitting on a photon, which is, by the way, impossible for a massive object, but if you could sit on a photon rocket, then space would disappear for you in the forward direction, in the direction that you are moving. So a photon, in a sense, can move instantly in its own time from one point of space to another. But since nothing else can ride a photon rocket, therefore the question is moot, if we could melt away all space. And also space doesn't melt away in every direction, it's just in the direction of movement of the photon.
Well, then it's just a question of observation. One sees the universe as...
Who is looking at from where.
Right. Exactly. So time is the difference, or should we call it distance? I mean, what is the math?
Distance and time can be interchanged in the theory of relativity to a certain extent. This is why time is called the fourth dimension in the theory of relativity. It's not really a fourth dimension in the sense that time and space cannot be completely interchanged, but in a certain situation, it can be partially interchanged. Mm. And this is why, for example, if we go on a high-speed spaceship near to the speed of light, not even has to be exactly the speed of light, when time disappears completely, and we can make a trip instantly. But even when we go at a very high speed, close to the speed of light, we have a phenomenon called time dilation. Time clocks slow down. So in my own time, on the spaceship time, I won't age as much as my cousin on Earth will have aged in the same time.
Well, that's exactly right. If we think of it in terms of traveling an amount of time at that speed, but if time is distance and we really are making space local by slipping in between space-time, then we're not traveling any distance or time at all.
No, exactly. This non-locality is wonderful because it really is instantaneous communication. So now, through non-locality, although we cannot move massive objects, but we certainly can communicate across space and time without spending any time at all. And that gives us all kinds of new phenomena to be experienced in the psychological dimension, not necessarily in the physical dimension, but at least in the psychological dimension.
Well, I like that because it allows us at least the opportunity, the possibility to observe at a distance that we couldn't think about before.
Or even experience at a distance. You know, some of this phenomenon of UFO, we sometimes throw them away offhand because they seem so outrageous. But when you think of them as psychological experiences of people, then it does not seem so outrageous. They could just be another aspect of quantum non-locality. We just have to imagine much more than we are capable of today. Because of materialism, our imagination has also become very narrow. If we broaden our imagination, then it is not hard to imagine models of psychological models of communication between human beings and extraterrestrials. The problem arises when we want to make a movie. There, of course, we have to have physical stuff and spaceships, and you know, that's where things become incredible, and we can laugh at them. But it's on the psychological dimension, on the other hand, non-locality allows us such wonderful depth and breadth of phenomenon that it's really worthwhile investigating and worthwhile imagining in those terms.
Well, maybe that's why we need science fiction, because it allows us to at least psychologically accept the impossible and then manifest beyond that.
Yes, I completely agree.
Well, is there an effect from things outside space and time on things inside space and time?
Well, actually, the possibilities are all outside of space and time, non-local consciousness.
Ah.
And then when we choose, we create space and time along with the objects of manifest world. So now what is outside, the potentia, becomes our experience that we frame to be part of a space-time world. But what we see is a projection. It really can be called a projection of consciousness. Consciousness projects space and time from the possibilities and constructs this material world to be situated in that space and time.
Well, so what we're saying then is then there's an outside observation occurring along with our third dimensional reality.
Yeah, the observation itself. But here is the really startling accurate statement that you can make, which is a little paradoxical initially, but when you think about it, this is the only way it has to be. Consciousness is everything. It's the ground of all being. Therefore, in order to see itself separate from itself, it literally has to split itself up into a part that sees the other part as an object. So the subject and object, we observer with his brain, is simultaneously created as the world that we project to be outside of us. So this is called in Buddhism, you know, in spiritual traditions, we have imaginations like that. So Buddhism has a concept called dependent co-arising. Quantum physics, up to 2,500 years later, has discovered the same thing, that consciousness becomes the subject and object which co-dependently arise, making this manifest universe of experience possible.
So
experience requires a subject and also an object. If the world were just objects, there would be no experience, because objects can only make objects. So this is the first curiosity, philosophical curiosity. How does the universe have experience, which requires a subject? It can't. So in materialism, there is no experience, and quantum physics agrees with it. There is only possibilities. So how do possibilities become actual events? It becomes actual event because of dependent co-arising. Consciousness literally splits itself up into a subject that looks upon itself as separate from the rest of the world, the objects. So in this way, consciousness becomes both the subject which is experiencing the world and outside of itself. That outside that you refer to is a creation of consciousness. In effect, everything is really inside of consciousness. But in the process of creating us as observers, we create also the world that is outside of us.
I got it. So is this the observation of us in another dimension, or is it the observation of God, or is it simply the rippling consciousness of another dimension?
Well, you can look at it from both perspectives. From the perspective of outside of space and time, the objective perspective, it is really God's creation. But from the perspective of us, we are creating the world, except that we are creating it co-dependent with the world. So we can say literally that we create the world and the world creates us.
Yeah, we're kind of like a working managers. We're managing the world in which we're also dependent upon the peas and carrots that grow around us. So we kind of have to take care of it all, ourselves and the world. It kind of takes us back to, I find it interesting that science is finally getting smart enough to catch up with the ancient masters. They already had all of this figured out, just in different terminologies, and now we're trying to put mathematics behind it and explain it. But it is a slow-changing religion, this modern science, is it not? Oh, did I lose my guest? That's a possibility. He can hear me and I can't hear him. And maybe you guys can hear him, but I can't hear him. Are we there? I'm live. All right. He's checking the guest right now. All right. When we talk about observation and we talk about being aware of ourselves, observing and also managing our creation, which we call life, we are also part of that life. So if we get too busy with our nose to the grindstone, we kind of forget about the creating part, and we stop being involved as creators. We stop being responsible as creators, and we start falling into the paycheck to paycheck thing, or we start feeling too material, where we have to worry about what car we drive or what home we live in or what clothes we wear or how many digits there are in our bank account, but we're not involved in the creation. And I guess maybe if you look back on it, if you were to look at, say, your high school graduation picture and then look at a picture of you now and try to really understand how much experience, how much time has gone between the two photographs, I think you'll be shocked to realize it's only been a few moments.
Yeah.
All right, you're back. We were just talking about this observation and management of a creation in which we are part of the creation. So we're kind of participating working managers in the creation.
And the, what participation is very significant. We participate in the world. In other words, we are part and parcel of the creation. Without us, there is no creation, just as creation is intended for creating us. So it's you know, John Wheeler, a great physicist, used to call it the meaning circuit. We complete the meaning circuit. Otherwise, there is no meaning to this world. We are the ones who can impose a meaning on whatever has taken place.
Well, I know, but we're trying, at least the world is trying to convince us that meaning means, you know, an effective, healthy, comfortable retirement. You know, the reality is there is no separation. No matter how much we try to think there is, we are all one, are we not?
Yes, we are all one. But within that oneness, the diversity of the manifest world is created because we want to bring aspects of that oneness, namely those fantastic archetypes, love, beauty, justice, truth, and goodness, and so forth, which reminds us of oneness. We want to bring those qualities in separateness, in the manifest world.
Ah.
So manifest world is created in such a way that it evolves towards this oneness. Oneness is not just a concept of being one, being capable of non-locally communicating, but oneness has this capacity of bringing together these fantastic concepts, making it manifest. Like, you can love another person separate from the person. At least you can make love. You can have sex with a person who is separate from.
One would have to also surmise that if that outer observation can affect us.
Of course, this is the reason that we are so driven, committed to love itself. You know, so many people search for love almost all of their lives. Why do we do it? Because we want to manifest the non-locality of love in our life. So non-locality or oneness is more than just being one. It's also manifesting that unity in the diversity.
Wow, that has a lot of ramifications. That means that
yes,
not just those actions, but other actions that we partake in or that we instigate have an effect on the universe.
Yes, absolutely. In other words, the universe is created with this idea that eventually will manifest all that is unmanifest, all the great beauty that is unmanifest initially. But that's why we move towards these great archetypes. Our whole movement of consciousness is designed to manifest these great archetypes. Just the very thing that you were saying, that in 100 years, our perception of these things changed so much. And 100 years from now, today we are so divided. 100 years from now, we'll be much less divided. And if you look at 100 years before, indeed, we were much more divided. So in this way, we evolve towards more and more unity as manifest in diversity. Not only unity in possibility, but unity in manifestation.
Well, I've got that. Now, I mean, this really opens the possibilities. It means that the atomic bomb China closet condition is in the forefront. If we go around killing and breaking things, these energies of fear, hatred, and obfuscation can have an effect on the entangled universe.
Absolutely. And they try to keep us from manifesting this entanglement that we were talking about before. Because as soon as these negative emotions come to us, immediately we feel separate. We are separate. We become separate because we refuse to look upon those things, those attributes of consciousness like love and beauty and justice, etc. That will unite us once again. So it all depends on where you are in our evolution. I believe, and the new science vindicates me, that we reincarnate many times in our lifetimes. We have had all of us have had many lives together, or we may not have been together all of our lives, but I distinctly suspect that you and I have spoken before in another life. And what happens during all these lives? Well, we move towards better and better manifestation of these archetypes. In other words, we have a purpose that we live. We live the purpose of manifesting these archetypes in ourselves. So as a result, as we move on, depending on our evolution, depending on our reincarnational history, we manifest various degrees these positive emotions. And as we manifest positive emotions, we can balance the negative emotions to a certain extent. The negative emotions are very problematic because they represent brain circuits in us. And when we fall into this brain circuit, it's really quite difficult to get out of it. I mean, what I'm talking about. When you are an angry person, it is difficult to get out of that anger and to, love your enemy, for example, which is one of the teachings of Jesus, where it's easy for Jesus to say, but it is very difficult for an ordinary mortal to be in that throw of anger, like, the Tea Party words right now. And all of a sudden, love the rest of us who are telling them, well, look, don't be so angry, don't be so angry. It's not easy because this brain circuits torment you. So what one has to do is to develop positive emotional brain circuits. But it's difficult. So we need to shift the paradigm, that at least to show these Tea Party goers it's important to have positive emotions. It's important to make brain circuits that will enable you to balance some of your negative circuits so that at least you know what it is to be neutral, if not loving to another person.
Well, when we talk about the spirituality of physics, or we talk about consciousness and its root being in matter, we're really splitting this science wide open. I look at the CERN collider right now. We're basically slamming protons into one another and watching them come apart, and we have all kinds of detectors in the room around this collision, trying to detect all the various frequencies, even if they only exist for a billionth of a second. And it's one thing to slam matter apart and see what it's made of. It's another entirely to gather up all those frequencies and try to make a single proton.
Well, that part is left to the material interactions themselves. And we don't have to do anything, of course. But the way the proton is made is that the quarks are forever confined. So when these objects collide, you literally will never have elementary particles like the quarks coming out. You will always will have protons and other elementary particles, which are made of quarks, but quarks cannot come out. So there will always be only these elementary particles coming out, along with their hope is that some new particles will come out called Higgs boson, and that will give us a support for the theory that we now have for these elementary particle interactions. But these are really, very speculative theories at this time. Nobody knows if the CERN accelerator is really going to produce any new data that will give us new insights.
Sure.
In fact, most people I talk to, but of course I talk to more skeptics than believers, there is the strong belief that this has been a boondoggle and red herring, and nothing much will come out of these things.
Well, it's kind of like the movie Contact, where S.R. Haddon said, why build one when you can build two at twice the cost?
the whole point is, it's a bit unfortunate because, we have very, very intelligent people, these very, very great physicists and engineers and technologists who are employed in places like Stanford, Harvard, great universities. And, the paradigm is over. Material paradigm, its limits are very clear. But these people have been trained in doing this high mathematics and high physics. And so they just cannot make up their mind to do something else. They could, of course. They're so brilliant, they could easily. But they just inertia is too much to take them in the same direction, so they cannot just give it up. You know, it's like a monkey. Have you ever seen a monkey which has put its hand in the bottle of candy and then grabs the candies, and because it's now made a fist, it cannot pull out its hand anymore because it cannot let go of the candy. It will have to have the fist. So it just cannot get out of the bottle, cannot get its hand out of the bottle. And these scientists seem to be like that, because they have grasped the candy, which is these machines and high expensive living and all this, and they just cannot let go and look at something else, because something else is much more interesting. Life is passing them by, but these experiments, you know, they're not going to lead to anything discernible that they can make, you know, huge theories or any new insights about anything.
Well, I don't know that's ever been the goal. I remember my brother spending years, literally years, writing grants and going back and forth to Washington, because that was the career. It really didn't matter if you discovered anything. The idea was to get the next grant.
Yeah. And, of course, their life is so detached from living, because living is about these archetypes: love, beauty, justice, truth, goodness, you know. But they have not an inkling, because they spend all their time in theorizing and experimenting. And, of course, these things can take horrendous time. This CERN accelerator took years and years to build it, and taken years and years to finally do an experiment. And then it will take years and years to analyze the experiment. So they keep busy, but they keep busy with such trivia. These are trivia compared to what we have to discover in the domain of consciousness, in the domain of the mind, in the domain of vital energies, let alone the archetypes, which can keep us busy for millions of years and has kept us busy for millions of years. You know, if you count the entire evolution of life on Earth, it's a 4 billion year occupation. Evolution keeps us busy at a much more intense level than these scientists even can imagine.
Well,
but unfortunately, you know, they're stuck with their models, and that's the way it is.
Well, but I do see even leaders of fairly prestigious projects like the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory up in Hanford, Washington, I do see them coming around. I see that, you know, this paradox of quantum physics, that they actually see that it might be solved if we accept consciousness as the ground of being.
Good. I'm glad that some of these hard-headed scientists you talk to also agrees to this. We are making some progress. You know how I know that? A New York Times columnist, wrote in a column which was addressed to some of the problems that President Obama was having. And it says right in the middle of the column that you are trying to do so many things. Maybe next you will try to tackle with quantum physics because you want to understand consciousness. now, that kind of comment, I'm paraphrasing, but only slightly, that kind of comment would not be made if the idea that quantum physics leads to deep insights about consciousness has not been around. So
yeah,
it is around, and I'm glad about that.
Yeah.
But it has become the basic idea to actually shift the paradigm is a big step. And that big step we need to make, because if we make this big step, then really we make a such enormous inroads, especially in two very urgent affairs, worldly affairs. One is health and healing, this cost of health care. That can be reduced to such an extent if we use the integrative medicine that is this new science is proposing. And the second field is economics. You know, I have a solution solutions will sound outrageous if you are a materialist, but if you heed the message of the new science, the solutions are very logical, not at all outrageous. And it can actually solve the problems of business cycle, these recessions that we have, that we are now getting involved in seriously. And, you know, all these questions of why Goldman Sachs did what it did must be forbidden and why it is completely wrong, and we must have a law that keeps them from doing this kind of thing again. This kind of thing today is arbitrary because everybody is saying, well, Goldman Sachs stayed within law. Yes, they stayed within law, but they did clearly something that is unethical. And then materialists will say, but what is the basis of ethics? This is the problem. In the new view, ethics is compulsory. Ethics is part of consciousness.
Sure.
So you cannot question ethics. So therefore, in economics, if we apply the new view, we immediately can frame what kind of legal restrictions we need to make so that capitalism gets back its free flow. I mean, I actually agree with Adam Smith capitalism wholeheartedly. The market's got to be free, but it's the lack of ethics that affects the freedom of the market, not the other way around.
Well, it's amazing to see that someone's ethics usually takes a mighty jump upward after they put $500 million in the bank for themselves.
Exactly.
And perhaps in physics there is a search for a consciousness constant or a function that will allow this reality into the proof that energies make up matter.
Well, the energies that now you are talking about are different energies. That they are the vital energies that we feel. And indeed, vital energies are manifest in the material part of ourselves that we call organs. The matter and energy, you know, this energy, this word is so confusing because energy usually means physical energy today. But even before the physical energy was conceived, which was 1837, we have always used the word energy, meaning vital energy. And vital energy becomes matter in a way of speaking in the form of biological matter. Vital energy is programmed into biological matter, and those are how the organs function. If we understand things that way, then it becomes very clear how consciousness works in us.
Yeah, because the result...
We should all be very careful when you use the word energy.
Right.
On one hand, there is the word physical energy, which is identical with matter. Matter and energy are completely equivalent. There is no difference between them. But as soon as you bring up the idea of energy as vital energy that we feel, that gives us life, that gives us vitality, then the whole aspect changes, and then what you just said begins to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, the physical energies are subject to the laws of entropy.
And that's why we feel the energy in our chakras where there are organs. In every chakra point where we feel our emotions, feelings, there is an important organ sitting there. That organ is the manifestation of that particular vital energy.
Right. Well, and we see highly organized, or I should say conscious direction in the vital energy, whereas the physical energy seems to obey the law of entropy and doesn't normally organize itself into more complex forms.
Exactly. That is the crucial point. I'm glad you brought up entropy. Physical dimension is subject to the law of entropy, and therefore we cannot do very much with it. But if we look at the vital energy, in fact, if we look at the vital, mental, supramental, this is precisely the solution of the economic problem, because these are unlimited dimensions where there is no zero-sum game, whereas in the material dimension, we do have a zero-sum game. And because of that zero-sum game, we have competition, we have impossible situations like you cannot have unlimited inflation, you cannot let the unemployment go down too much, because then you are going to have inflation, and the inflation eventually cannot go on indefinitely. We're going to have recession. So this business cycle problems is unsolvable when it is a zero-sum game. Whereas if we bring in the unlimited aspect of our subtle energies, for example, then there is no zero-sum game, and we can expand our economy forever in those directions and live happily forever. I mean, the ending ultimately is that if we carve our material dimension of greed and need, etc., and expand our need in the vital, mental, supramental dimension, then we really can be very happy economic beings, because there is no need for competition, because what we are looking for is unlimited.
Yeah, exactly. The economy expands to the point where money becomes obsolete. We're going to take a quick break, about 4 minutes, a quick musical break, get a glass of water or whatever, let our affiliates recognize themselves around the world. My guest tonight, Dr. Amit Goswami. His website is amitgoswami.org. Check it out during the break. We'll be back in about 6 minutes with more X Squared Radio. Don't go away. We'll be right back.